I am Lawrence Van Note from Eastern Iowa, and I have an anonymity break on my hands. I don't hear you. My name is Van. Vanner. When I was drinking, I was good old drunken Larry. That guy, I got tired. I got sick and tired of him. And I finally came to AA, and I found if I was going to stay sober and be happy in so doing, that I had to change a lot of things about myself, the way I thought and so forth. So I decided we would take this Larry personality, the drunk, and we'd get rid of him and replace him with a guy called Van, who is sober. So that is the reason why I have an anonymity break. It's all, of course, in jest. I'm very happy to be here with you. I have especially pleasing happy bonus tonight. My grandfather's sponsor is here from San Diego, California. The gentleman that sponsored my sponsor, who did such a beautiful job of helping me, is here. And he is, I won't tell you how long he's been in AA, but I will tell you that in our hometown of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, he was at his first meeting over 31 years ago. And when I walked in this room and here sat Billy, I was just, that just made my day for me. We have a number of good speakers. I just met them 15 minutes ago. I know all about them. I'll give you a beautiful long resume and a rundown on all their accomplishments. And, you know, in AA, we don't need to do that. I went to my granddaughter's graduation, and the master ceremony, the chairman spent more time introducing the speaker than the speaker did in speaking. We don't do that in AA. So I think tonight I asked who wanted to lead off. None of them want to lead off. That's typical. Finally it was decided I would make the decision to lead off. And I think our difference in women's lip being what it is today, I'm going to play it safe. And I'm going to ask Jackie S. from New York City to be our lead-off speaker in this meeting. Jackie?
Hi, my name is Jackie Solomon, another anonymity break, and I'm from New York. And it was really very funny because he said, really the reason I'm leading off is because I'm low man on a totem pole. They all have seniority on me, so I got stuck. But in any event, hi. Sorry. I'm one of those shorties. In any event, I really would like to tell you how wonderful it is to be here for me. It truly is a wonderment. Not only the fact that I've been asked to speak at this particular meeting, but the fact that I'm in Denver. For a little girl who couldn't cross the street as a result of alcohol, that's quite a remarkable feat. And I mean that quite literally, but that's part of what was to come later in my alcoholism. I'm one of those kids that was born from an alcoholic family. I don't think it really has very much to do with my alcoholism, frankly, unless there's a predisposition towards it. However, I was a setup emotionally for what was to follow. Since my mother and father were alcoholics, they found it inconvenient to take care of me. They couldn't stay sober long enough to open a can of tuna fish. And as a result, they would send me to New York to live with these people on occasion, and then my mother would sober up and ask me to be shipped back to Connecticut again in her, as I say, sober moments. And I think the shifting back and forth for the ensuing 3 years between 3 and 6 kind of left me in a emotional basket case. I didn't know where I belonged, who I belonged to, and I felt very much abandoned, rejected, and unloved, although certainly I didn't know any of those labels at that time. And all I knew was that in growing up, I had this feeling of a can of worms running around in the middle of my stomach all the time, which I covered up very neatly and very beautifully with what I called my New England ramrod up the back posture. You know, it was the stiff upper lip, and nothing's going to get you down, and you can handle everything yourself, kid. And I did pretty well until alcohol entered the picture. But as a matter of fact, I was not one of those very young drinkers in the sense of starting at a very early age, and I was quite convinced that I would not be an alcoholic. I was not going to be like my mother and father. I really knew better, and I was much too smart for that to happen to me. However, as time went on, with these foster parents that I live with, they were marvelous people who gave me much love and much security and much affection, but somehow it was never enough. And I think that that was at the root of all my problems. I was, as I say, an emotional basket case in the sense of love. I felt that I needed it. And somehow or other that word need places a demand immediately. I should have at that time realized that what I wanted was love rather than needed it. But I didn't understand how to examine myself internally at all. I didn't drink until I started working. I was rather disappointed. I always wanted to be somebody I wasn't. I wanted to be more intellectual than I was capable of being. And as a result, in my growing up years in high school, I would travel back and forth in the community where I lived. We had an elevated train, and I would ride the elevated train carrying books of Rousseau and Plato and Aristotle, and I would carry these things to make me feel like someone. I would read them occasionally, not understanding anything of what was being said. I didn't really grasp the philosophies that they were trying to put forth. But in any event, it was all a posture. It was all a let's pretend or let's make believe that you're well put together. And it was a control that unfortunately was to do me in later years, because I thought I could control alcohol the way I controlled my outward manifestations of everything, my personality, my jobs. These people that I lived with were fine. They didn't drink. However, my foster father was a compulsive gambler. And when I had set my sights on going to college, and I was determined to go to Yale, because at that time they accepted gals, it's not so strange. They took them for journalism and fine arts. And so he proceeded to lose all of our money just as I graduated from high school, and that went down the tubes. And I was really crushed by it. But along with being crushed, I also realized now that there was a very tremendous amount of snobbery involved, because my foster mother said to me, well, you can go on to a city college. And I said, oh, no, no, I'll have none of that. I said, I'll go out and work. Of course, I was incapable of doing anything. I didn't know stenography. I didn't know typing. All I had was a nice smile, starched dresses, and white gloves. And that was all I had to offer the business world. And there I went, out into the business world. And my first job was with a dreadful little house dress manufacturer, and he hired me under false pretenses because he hired me as his secretary, and he used to lock the door and chase me around the room, and he would chase me over the table and over under the desk and around the sofa, and I was too dumb to quit, and so after 3 weeks, he never caught me, incidentally, but at the end of 3 weeks, he called me into the office, and he said, I'm afraid I'll have to let you go. You haven't lived up to my expectations. And he was quite right. But this leads me up to drinking, because working in the same place was a very sophisticated, very well-glued-together lady whom I'm still very friendly with, who has no alcoholic problem. And she invited me out for a drink to celebrate this great occasion of my being fired. And I went with her, and I remember very distinctly I was very impressed by her. By her seeming sophistication. Well, she was sophisticated and a very bright woman. And we went across to the McAlpin Hotel, and she ordered a martini, and I ordered a martini. Now, it wasn't my first experience with alcohol. I had had the usual Canadian club, perhaps, at a prom, which I didn't like. I really was not a drinker. I never had especially any taste for it, but I mastered the feat anyway. And I had my first martini, and wonder of wonders, a can of worms disappeared. It just kind of went away, and I no longer had that kind of funny rumbling around in the middle of my stomach like two emery boards rubbing together. I suddenly felt all of a piece. I didn't feel 10 feet tall, nor did I feel that I could accomplish great things, but I felt calm and composed. And it did not take me... I did not immediately become an alcoholic. It was a long, slow process for me. It was 10 years of what I called my social drinking, or the gracious drinking, where it involved parties and dances and social activities. And I really was pretty much in control in those circumstances. There were a few occasions, a few signposts along the road that were to indicate what was to come. And, of course, I blithely ignored those completely. And my mother on occasion would say, don't you think you drink a little too much? And I would say, oh, not at all. My mother being my foster mother at this point. And In any event, this continued for 10 years. But the amazing thing to me now, in hindsight, of course, is that it never occurred to me to examine myself internally to find out what possibly caused these very insecure feelings inside. I bluffed my way through life. I did have good jobs. I managed to live rather nicely without any difficulty. However, I thought each external circumstance was going to put me all together. It was either going to be a new job, a new beau, a new apartment, a vacation. Something was always going to make me feel all put together. And, of course, it would last for a period of time. It would last for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month or 6 months, perhaps. And then I'd fall apart again because I was left with the same old me. Nothing had changed except momentarily and external. And it wasn't until I came here that I realized that what I had to do was change me, not the outside. And in any event, one of my externals that I thought was going to be the ultimate solution was getting married. I did when I was 30, much to my family's delight. And in any event, my husband and I, shortly after we got married, went to rent a house in the country. And we left in February, and we drove out to the area. And while we were out there, we became snowbound. Now, it lasted 3 days. And at this point, I guess I had become a daily drinker, but not excessively, although I was consuming, I'm sure, rather larger quantities than any of my friends. I had a large capacity, as many of us know about. And in any event, we drove out. We were snowbound for 3 days, and we thought it was kind of a lark. We didn't have any food in the house. We had no alcohol in the house where we were staying. There were no cigarettes, and we thought, oh, my, this is great fun, you know. And we shoveled out and started back in the car to New York, and I got, at that time, what I called a case of nerves. I started to shake from head to toe. My heart started to pound so I couldn't breathe. I had air hunger. My hands were perspiring. I was really, truly a mess. And I was absolutely convinced I was having a heart attack. Now, that was to begin a series of 10 years of heart attacks every 10 minutes. I went to more heart specialists for EKGs. And I was convinced that I was going to be the one patient that would walk out the door and fall dead at the doorstep. And truly what it was withdrawal. My system was withdrawing from alcohol, and what I craved was a drink. When I got back to New York that particular afternoon, after going through this withdrawal, which I didn't know anything about, of course, I knew nothing about alcoholism. I just knew that it was not. I was told at 13 I shouldn't drink. It ran in the family. And that was all I knew about it. In any event, I got back to New York, of course, had a drink, and felt wonderful. All of the feelings went away, and the willies went away, and 2 days later it happened again, because I was the sort of person who did not drink during the day, not because I was concerned that it would reflect on the fact that I might be an alcoholic. It just made me sleepy, and I couldn't work. So I didn't drink during the day, and I would fight all day long and wait for 5 o'clock when I could go to the happy hour and have my usual number of scotches or whatever. In any event, I remember that day in particular on 42nd Street. I started to shake all over again, and my lack of knowledge about alcoholism made me think I had the flu. I had no idea that this again was withdrawal, and I went in for a cup of tea, and my hand shook, and I couldn't pick up the cup of tea, and I went back and said to my boss, I'm falling apart. I don't know what's the matter with me. I think I'm having a heart attack, right? Another heart attack. And up I went to another cardiologist, and he examined me. And he had no clue that I was involved in alcohol, because it never occurred to me that that was my problem. And I thought that I was just an emotional, nervous wreck. I was filled with anxieties, and unfortunately, that was to begin the next 10 years of my drinking. Curiously enough, the only thing that seemed to minimize the fear was to have a drink. And of course it did, temporarily, momentarily. It would ease it so that I could function for a little while. And then of course the alcohol would in my system would diminish, and then I would need another drink. And what I didn't realize that what I was doing was every time I had a drink, I created more anxiety and more panic, and so therefore I had to increase the alcohol. No one seemed to be able to clue me into this. Nobody seemed to be able to tell me what was wrong with me, and I certainly didn't have a clue. I eventually, 4 years after I was married, had a child, and I thought, here's the ultimate answer. Now I will stay home, another external, right, in my life, and I will be a good mother, and I won't have to do this stuff anymore. There won't be anything to be afraid of. Because when I tell you I was afraid, I wish that there was some way I could verbalize those fears. I used to go to work, and I worked on the 18th floor, and I would stand in the middle of the showroom and was convinced that I was going to be lured out the window. Every time I heard a siren in the street, it was coming after me. I knew that I was going to die that minute, and I was absolutely convinced of it. I shook all the time, my hands were sweaty all the time, and my heart palpitated all the time. I was always running around gasping for breath. I had no clue that it was alcohol. I can't imagine today that I could have been so dumb. But in any event, after my child was born, now began the series of staying home and taking care of the baby and going to the park. Well, the park was a block and a half from my home, and in order to do that, there was no way I could walk the block and a half. I was too terrified, literally. I was too afraid to go out of my apartment and walk a block and a half, so I took a thermos of vodka and soda to the park, and while the other mothers drank Coke and their orange juice, I drank vodka and soda, and I sipped in a very ladylike fashion because I had everything under control. You see, my home was under control. I thought I was under control. Everything was clean. My child was clean. My husband was clean. The house was clean. The cats were clean. Everything was in order. But this terrified, shambling wreck that really, at this point, I now could no longer go to a department store, a supermarket, get my hair cut. I could not go anywhere without the benefit of alcohol, and then it had to be considerable before my senses were dulled sufficiently to take the pain away or the fear away, to minimize the fear so that I could function at all. And, of course, in the interim, I had been to psychiatrists, psychologists. I tried psychodrama for a while. That's a kicker. You go in and you sit on people's laps and you play your uncle, your aunt, your sister, your mother, your cousin. And this is to get at the root of your emotional problem. Well, my problem was no longer emotional, it was alcoholic. And unfortunately, now strangely enough, I didn't drink during that 6-week period. For some, I don't know how I managed not to, but I didn't, because I really basically knew now what my problem was, and I wanted to get well. However, at the end of 6 weeks, feeling all put together again, I met a friend of mine for lunch, and she said to me, "My dear, are you still wearing that old coat?" How could she be so cruel? The only thing I could think of was a martini. And I had the martini. I had no way of coping. I had no tools. I had no way of understanding that my ego was standing in the way of my getting well. And in any event, that was the end of psychodrama, obviously. And all of these psychiatrists and psychologists would offer pills, Librium, Valium, whatever. Fortunately, I'm not a pill-addicted person. I'm not hooked on most, thank God. And so I would take the usual dosage of 3 a day, and I'd say, "You see, that they don't work." And I'd give them to my neighbor or leave them in the closet and have another drink, because that, to me, worked. And I was able to function with the alcohol. This continued really getting, the fears were getting progressively worse as the alcohol, of course, got progressively worse. And I was really consuming a considerable amount at this point. And still under the guise of control, I still thought I was functioning somewhat. I had now reduced my diet to, I didn't want anything to eat at all, so I was living on Alka-Seltzer on the rocks, potato chips and dill pickles. I cut out the potato chips because they were fattening. And, one of the strange things is that I was quite a passive drinker. I mean, I wasn't into violence and striking out and hitting people and that sort of thing. And I was, as I say, a very frightened person. But just to show you how the courage of the alcoholic and the insanity of it works, I live on probably one of the busiest corners in New York. It's the corner of 37th Street and 2nd Avenue, where all the traffic goes into the Queens Midtown Tunnel and the Cary buses come out to go out to the airport. And I was annoyed that they did not have a patrolman on that corner. So I called one day and I said, "I really don't understand the police department. You should have a patrolman on this corner." And they said, "Well, we're sorry, madam, we have no one available." And I said, "Would you mind if I did it?" And I said, "Not at all." And I want you to know that I got all dressed up for the occasion. I put on a big striped tent dress, and I had little short white gloves, and my son had a Colonel Ked whistle, and I took that down. And I stood on that corner, and I held up those trucks and those Carry limousines, and I did the best darn job you ever saw. Until one truck driver leaned out the window, and he said to his companion, "God, she's smashed." And I was so offended. I was so indignant that I left. But in the meantime, my neighbor, who had helped me during some of my periods of rigidity, when I really was so frightened I couldn't move, would come in the evening and put me in a tub to soak or something, and she, of course, didn't understand it. She's not a drinker. She had come around the corner at this precise moment and seen me standing in the middle of this chaos directing traffic, and she said, "I can't believe it." You know. But we do strange things, obviously. In any event, the end result of this is that I finally, in 1968, I went to another doctor, and I knew that I was really in pretty bad shape. I mean, there was just no question about it. My hair was falling out. I had no nails. I was bloated beyond description. I had that ruddy outdoor glow, which I contributed to the fresh air. And I had red marks all over my face and my neck and my shoulders, those wonderful little spiders we get all over the place. And I went to see this man, and he did a blood test, and he said, "You have no blood." And he was absolutely right. It was 98% alcohol. And he said, "How do you function?" And I said, "I really don't know. I put one foot in front of the other." He said, "I would like to hospitalize you. However, you cannot have a drink for 24 hours. Otherwise, you cannot be admitted to the hospital." They didn't have rehab programs at that time in our area. And I don't know what happened, but I left his office. And if there is a power that we turn things over to, which I certainly did not understand at that time, I turned something over to someone or something. Because I went home and I did not drink for 24 hours. And miraculously, with all of the alcohol that I had consumed, I was certainly doomed for convulsions and DTs. But that sheer will for survival got me through the next 24 hours. I was hospitalized, and I was to remain there for 3 weeks, where they discovered all the fringe benefits of 20 years of drinking. Acute cirrhosis. Malnutrition of the hip, would you believe? That's bone erosion in the hip, actually, and they thought that I would be an invalid if I lived, which they doubted very sincerely. And a few other sundry things, acute malnutrition, of course, which required many transfusions. But the strange thing about it is that after the alcohol was removed from my system in about 3 days, and I was able to think somewhat clearly, I knew that I didn't want to drink. I now had a choice. The fears were magically gone. Those unknown, unnamed fears that I really could not tell anybody about, because when I tried to, they'd slam me on the back and say, "What do you mean you're afraid? There's nothing to be afraid of. You're a good, strong, healthy girl." You know, but I was terrified, absolutely terrified all the time. I'd forget subways and buses and cabs. I mean, when I tell you I couldn't cross the street, that's really what it amounted to. In any event, when I came out of the hospital, and the doctor, of course, had warned me that I could not drink again, I really didn't care because I didn't want to drink again. I was really one of those blessed, fortunate people who did not have that eternal struggle or that yearly struggle or whatever it is that makes them want to stop. I really, truly was gifted in that way. And I didn't know really enough about AA to know whether I was going to come here or not, but a neighbor of mine who's in the program and lives down the hall knocked on my door one night and said, "There's a new meeting starting up the street." I knew she was in the program. "Would you like to come?" And I said, "Sure." And I went up, and I really didn't understand what any of you were talking about. You all talked in code. It was absolutely the most mysterious thing that I'd ever heard. But I knew that there was something in that room that was magic. And whatever it was, I wanted a little piece of it. I didn't know how much I could get, but I sure as heck was going to try. And I tried to be the best AA that ever lived, you know. I was going to be Miss AA in 24 hours and get healthy and well all at once. Well, it has taken a long time, and I have a long way to go, but the process has been simply fantastic. One of the things that I have discovered in this program is that the more I let go of just about everything, and I took me a long time to understand even that phrase. I was very busy controlling life, and it seemed to be very paramount to me that I be in control of my life and my circumstances and my fate and know what was going to happen to me and have a blueprint. And that doesn't seem to be important anymore. If I had guessed for a moment or projected for a moment that I would be here speaking to you tonight, I would have been wrong or been frightened or said no or whatever. And I think that the only solution for me is to ride with the day, to flow with the day, to let it happen to me. Because as a result, it makes it easier for me to communicate with you, for me to be able to hear what you say. It took me a long time to listen. I got my back against the wall after I'd been in the program 2 years. I thought I understood the steps pretty well, but I guess I didn't have a clue. But I'm one of those people that has to be hit right between the eyes before they take any action, obviously, as I did with alcoholism. And I dove into the steps because they were my salvation. I really believed that I was going to have a mental breakdown, and I might very well have, had I not resorted to the steps, which are my lifeline. They've helped me to grow, and it's amazing to me when I read the steps, which I do quite often or periodically, that the little elves are at work at night, and they put in words I've never seen before. And I can't understand how I've overlooked them and missed them, and there they were all the time, but I wasn't ready to receive them. I wasn't ready to hear them yet. But as time goes on, there is more and more that is able to come into me, and that helps me to give more to you. I don't know that there really is very much more that I can say. It's pretty much the whole thing, except that it's simply marvelous to be alive. It's marvelous to be here and to share with you. Thank you.
Thank you a lot, Jackie. I think we all know, at least we alcoholics, let's talk about the fear, not being able to cope with life, and then finding that golden elixir that made us a little better than anybody else. The young man here that I sponsored, I like a little term, the way he states it. He said, with every drink he took, he got an inch taller, he got 10 pounds heavier, and his IQ went up 10 points. Isn't that a pretty good description of a drinking alcoholic? Fit me real well. It's a good thing, Jackie, I didn't come along in one of my blind, drunken stupors when you were directing traffic, or we'd probably had trouble. Now, how's the kind of guy, I could lose a Packard car, take me 4 days cruising in the cab to find the darn thing. I never could figure that out. Now I think we'll jump clear across the North American continent from east to west and call on a gentleman from British Columbia. And incidentally, I think the man's Irish, and I'd like to let you people in on a secret. I run around with a Dutch name, Van Note. That's, you can't get more Dutchy than that, right? I'm like Irish soap. I'm 99% Irish. So I'll give you Pat O from British Columbia.
Thank you, Van. Good evening, everybody. My name is Pat O'Hara, and I'm an alcoholic. And with a name like that, you gotta be a rummy, where I come from. I better tell you now, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous after about 30 years of stumbling down the booze beat. But I'm not really that old, you understand. I got an early start. I think it's important that you understand that. But I come from British Columbia, which some of you may not be up on your geography. It's Canada's most westerly province. And we're a large, sprawling area. And according to our Chamber of Commerce, it's Canada's evergreen playground. I get a couple of bucks for telling you that, from the Chamber of Commerce. But we're a large area, as I said, very rugged. To give you some idea of the size of the province of British Columbia, and in AA geography, British Columbia and the Yukon Territory are one. So, I'll tell you, everybody knows about Texas. Well, if you come from Texas, you come on up to British Columbia and you bring Texas with you. And we'll put you down in the corner and, you know, we won't bother you if you don't bother us. But I'm a drunk, and I think my drinking career is explained real well in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in that chapter, A Vision for You. It talks about normal folks, where drinking means conviviality, companionship, the colorful imagination, release from the care and boredom, and the joyous intimacy of friends and a feeling that life is good. And I experienced all of those things for quite a number of years. I had a real ball with booze. And then I started to try, and when booze got me into trouble, and I didn't remember too well, and I still kept trying to recapture those great moments of the past, when booze was my friend. And that went on for quite a number of years, and it was truly a heartbreaking obsession, trying to live, to organize, to develop a pattern of drinking where I could drink and control my life. It just wasn't happening. I didn't, all those easier, softer ways that, well, you all know about those. And you no doubt you all tried them. And they didn't work any better for me than they worked for you. You know, I think about drinking today, I think of it that it's a great deal like that old song, the old Strawberry Roan. Man, if I got up on the old Strawberry Roan, that would be a very rough ride. But along the way, I talked to a doctor and a man of the cloth. Even had a short conversation with a psychiatrist. That was a short one because he was too damn nosy. Didn't have too much to do with him. But I understand that the psychiatrists today, this going back almost 20 years, they don't waste too much time with an alky anymore. They take one smell, and then they say, what do you want to be when you grow up? I understand that terminates the conversations most times right there. The doctor gave me a few pills that, I knew I was getting stupid, but the pills made me even stupider, so I threw them away. And I took antabuse one time, quietly, and quickly drank a glass of beer, and I didn't get sick, so I said, they're no damn good, and I threw them away. Went back to drinking. And the man of the cloth, of course, the only thing he could promise me was that if I didn't mend my way, I would surely go to hell. Well, I knew more about that than he did. So, it's the way it goes. But I got into the usual amount of trouble. My drinking career was kind of dull. I was a dull drunk. Believe me. But you know, the things that I did to my family, to my parents, to my friends, and I got married, and the things that happened to my wife and my children. I have two beautiful girls and two wonderful boys. And at that particular time, my girls were teenagers. And it was very embarrassing to them that Pappy came home drunk every night. But, you know, I didn't want to be a drunk. I knew about drunks. My father was one. His father before him. And I certainly didn't want to be like that. And when I started drinking, I had no plans to be a drunk. It just worked out that way. So I got along to where I think I guess you could say I was a loser. I was just a loser. I don't think I was a born loser. I heard a born loser explained, defined one time, and they said that a born loser is a guy who, when he's born, the doctor holds him the wrong end up and slaps him in the face. They explained a loser as being a guy when he phones the suicide prevention center and they put him on hold. But here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found some wonderful things. People who come from all over the world, from all walks of life. From different backgrounds and all. Speaking of backgrounds, story I want to tell you about the little boy who came home from Sunday school and he said to his mom, "Is it right, Ma, that we all come from dust?" And she said, "That's right, son." "And that when we die, we go back to dust?" And she said, "That's right." "Why are you asking these questions?" "Well," he said, "I looked under my bed and it looks like somebody's either coming or going." I don't know what that's got to do with staying sober or getting drunk or anything. But then, having been a fall-down drunk, and I took a few cures along the way. But I'm going to tell you about the last cure I got. Up in our country, the boys in blue, and we got the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and they don't like the way I drive a car when I'm drunk. So I got into lots of trouble that way, and I wound up taking a cure from dear old Magistrate James Bartman, City of Vancouver, and he gave me a cure 90 days in the bucket. Well, up there that time, if you behaved yourself, 90 days was 75 days, and you know, I'm a guy with my ethnic background and all. I hadn't gone to work on the 17th of March for as long as I could remember, and they turned me loose on the 17th of March. And I say, you know what happened. Well, it did. But you know, the next 3 months, although they were hell, that was the beginning of the end. Because it was on the 19th day of July that I first contacted Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you know, I never knew anybody who was a member of AA. Because back those days, a lot of people here tonight, I know that they remember the days of total and complete anonymity. And I never knew anybody who was a member of AA, who had been a drunk and was sober. So I'd been around AA, though, for about a year, and I met a business acquaintance who I'd known for many years. And he came over to me and shook my hand, and he said, "I never expected to see you here, but I'm not surprised." But, you know, there's only so many words that you can use in trying to express gratitude. And I think that they've all been used many times. And you've heard them so many, many times. And I haven't, I'm not a very eloquent man. As a matter of fact, in my wanderings around that I've been allowed to go because of what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the privilege of being in the old beautiful city of Cork. And I went out to Blarney Castle. And believe it or not, I'm the only man that is known who kissed the Blarney Stone and immediately got laryngitis. And that is a fact. So I don't have anything to tell you very much about gratitude. I am very grateful for being here and being allowed to be up here at this podium today. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, this was the beginning of a brand new way to live. And the man said, and they read part of chapter 5, and they said, "If you want what we have." And I didn't know what you had, but I knew what I had. I had the most nothing of everything. That's what I had. Plus about 1,000 defects of character, most of which I still have. And I see some people from British Columbia here, and they'll say amen to that one. But these people, they cared, and they shared, and they encouraged me. And you know, that was even honestly, there was some people, some of them who had been around long enough to have that degree of serenity that we all strive so far for, who would even say, "How are you, Pat?" Now that's a leading question to ask a half-dry drunk. But it really happened. Well, I got a lot of encouragement from my wife and from my family. And I was no longer the resident genius. And I got all the help that my sponsor, I had a good sponsor. He helped me enormously. And he told me that if I wanted to learn how to live without drinking, one of the first things I was going to have to do was learn to listen. And that's pretty difficult for most of us. because I've shared experiences with countless thousands of people. And that's one thing that we seem to have in common, that we're great know-it-alls, and to have to learn to listen. Well, I did that to the best I could. But, you know, over the years, from a very young man, I'd always had dreams of youth, of really being something. And one of my idols, if you will, of when I was a teenager, was a very great American, a wonderful little guy, one of the greatest humorists of all times. Out of Oklahoma was Will Rogers. And I always used to think, when he'd say, and he used to say it with such sincerity that you had to believe him, that I never met a man I didn't like. And all my life I had wished that I could be like that. I wished that he, so desperately to be able to say I never met a man I didn't like. But that wasn't to be. It wouldn't work for me. But there was another great American of a bygone day with whom I could identify real quickly. And that was Mark Twain. And when he wrote that he had never committed to murder, but he had read a lot of obituaries with a great deal of pleasure, then I could go for it. You know, I love to hear laughter at an AA meeting because I immediately know that there's people out there just crazy as I am. And you make me feel comfortable. Well, back to Will Rogers for a minute. One of the things he used to say that I've come back to me since I've been drunk, or been sober rather, is he used to say that to live your life in such a way that you can sell the family parrot to the village gossip. Now, there's no way a drunken kid can do that. He's got to wring that bear's neck. But we wish, and for all these nice things, and we sit there and keep drinking, and we keep wishing, and wishing never makes it so. Because we can't change our way of life. Wishing. That reminds me of a story that this couple, they're going on a holiday, and he's a lush, and he's, as soon as they got away off on the road, he started drinking, and by the time they got to a beautiful summer resort, pull off the side of the road to get something to eat, and it's all done up so beautifully, and there's a big stoned-in wishing well, so they wander over there, and it's about 30, 40 feet deep, and away down on the bottom, it's all lit up, and there's about 10 inches of water, and there's a bunch of great big boulders. And there's a few coins down in there, and they're reflecting on the water, these coins. And in true fashion, they threw their coins in. But Lushy, when he threw his in, he leaned over a little too far, and he fell down. And when his wife looked in, see how far down he really was, and the condition he was in, and all the twists he had, she knew that the game was over. And she was heard to say, "My God, this thing really works." You people are crazy, you know what? Absolutely mad. But I kept coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. That first year, I think I went to 365 meetings. I really do. And I learned a lot about me. And as I mentioned before, I had a good sponsor, and what I didn't learn about me, he told me. And I didn't always like the things he told me, mind you, but I had a lesson. But about that time, I remember getting... Many years before, as a teenager, when I first went out on the slave market, I worked for a man who has been very successful in business. And he's talking to me, and he said, "You know, Pat, you can do a job for 20 years, or you can have 20 years experience." And I never thought about that again until I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, I wonder if that would work now. So I kind of got my thinking into that gear, and away I went. And that's the way it has worked out. My life has been a series of beautiful and wonderful experiences. And AA up in our country is no different than it is down anywhere else that any of you come from. There's, for some unknown reason, you get that idea that you don't like somebody. I don't think that's an alcoholic problem or condition at all. I think that that's just human. Some of you say, "Well, I just don't like that guy." Well, when that happens to me, I go out of my way to get to know that person. And almost invariably, I can find something that I can like. And even when all else fails, he can still help me because I'll say, you know, I'm glad I'm not like that SOB. But there's an old Irish saying, and I believe this, and as I look around the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter where I go, and I listen to the sharing of experiences, and I think of this old Irish saying, and it says, in defeat, there is a spiritual advantage. So, as I said, I really believe this. And naturally, coming from Ireland, I believe that if there's any people in this world who have had a postgraduate course in defeat, it's got to be the Irish. But reasonably early in my AA life, I tried to be of service to the group I belonged to. If they wanted me to do something and I could do it, I did it to the best of my ability. And as time progressed, I got interested in the legacy of service. And that has been a wonderful, terrific, gratifying experience to serve and to be of service, hopefully. Now, as a result, I've had many years of real terrific experiences. Now, I'm going to tell you some of the things that happened to me along the way as a direct result of what you people taught me when I came here. And many of them are very wonderful things, and I'm not bragging or boasting. It's just the way it is. It's part of my story. You know, I remember one time listening to a young fellow not too long ago in North Vancouver, up in my corner of the world. And he was a young man, and he was having trouble identifying because he said he was so young that he didn't think he looked like a drunk. And it was really causing him a lot of concern at that time. And that reminded me of an occasion when I was up in the White Horse, up in the Yukon Territory. Now, I had never been there before. I didn't know anybody who lived there. But I had to go up there to make an AA report. And I phoned this man and told him what flight I was coming in on. And he said, well, I'll meet you. And it was in the fall of the year, and I went up there on a plane loaded with mostly Americans going up there big game hunting. And we walked across the tarmac and into the airport. And standing there in the crowd of people, and there were various guides getting their guys together and what have you. And finally, a guy came over to me, and he tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, are you Pat O'Hara? And I said, that's me. And he turned to his friend, and he said, I told you. And I had a few choice words for him. I hadn't had a drink at that time for 12 or 13 years, and I still looked like a drunk. And it's a wonderful experience, it's just the same. All the nice things that have happened to me, they're really too numerous to mention. But some of the things that have happened to me that could have been tragic. I have trouble with airlines. You know, they take me someplace and leave me. Go on strike and the hell with you like. That's what they do. Dear old Air Canada left me stranded in New York City the first time I went there. Some smart ass of a delegate that was serving with me, he knew about this, and he said, you're one delegate that they don't want back. It always makes you feel at home. Went to Miami Beach in 1970. Coming home, get down to the Northwest Orient Airline. Or didn't get on, went down to the departure lounge. They'd already taken my baggage. And when we should have been going up the ramp onto the plane, in come the crew, and they said, we're not flying nowhere today. And when I told one of my friends about it a couple of weeks later, he said, oh, you caused that crash. And I said, what do you mean I caused it? Well, he said, they took one look at you and said, if that's the kind of trash we haul, we quit. I got some beautiful friends. Then once again, last year, dear old Air Canada stranded me in Shannon, Ireland. Oh, I love them people. One day in New York City, standing under the marquee waiting to get a cab to go someplace, and I was with another guy from British Columbia who back home we'd been pretty good friends. And over the years, every time involved in service, and somebody would tell me, by God, O'Hara, you're getting to be a wheel. You better remember what dogs do to wheels. And I got that once, I got it 100 times. And eventually I was elected area delegate, chairman, and, man, watch those dogs, boy. And eventually got elected delegate. Well, that was the wheel treatment for sure. You're sure getting to be a wheel, O'Hara. Watch for the dogs. Well, standing under this marquee this day in the pouring rain, and there's a woman underneath there with a little dog on a leash. I haven't told you yet. Well, it seems that the little dog, he was standing by the doorpost, and I happened to be looking down at the moment, and my friend was looking down at this little dog because he had one just like it at home. And just with that, he started to do on doorposts what dogs do. And at the same moment, the woman starts off walking, dragging this little boy on the leash, and he's hopping along on three legs, and if it hadn't been for some fancy footwork, man, I'd have got it that time. Well, my friend started to laugh, and we eventually got in the cab, and he's still killing himself, and I said, you should drop dead right here in the streets of New York. He said, if you don't tell the folks back home about this, I'm going to... Another friend said, well, you know, if a dog ever makes it, I'll give him a lifetime supply of kennel ration. As I said, I got some beautiful friends. But I have had a terrific life in the past 18 years. Wonderful, memorable experiences. I have a big book, I was telling the boy here just before the meeting started, that has been signed by countless hundreds of people from all over the world. And I use it as my, that is my own Mount Rushmore. Because when I feel sorry for poor old me, I get that book out and I look at all these people and brings back the wonderful memories of wonderful, warm, beautiful friends. I see so many, many things. And from the walls of memory, the smiling faces and thousands of memorable experiences that it's just unbelievable. And along the way, you meet some wonderful friends. You really do. I have, anyway, and I know that other people have had the same experience because I have shared experiences with them. And from Bob Hitchens, our man in New York, who says, walk with patience the road before you. I think about that a lot. I got another friend down in southern Florida. I met him, oh, God, I guess 15 years ago, and every time we get together, we have a ball, and we run into one another all over the world, the little world that I've been able to travel in anyway. And there's Dan Graham from down in Florida, and he says, be quick to laugh at everything so as not to have to cry. And I've had times when I've had to use that. But, you know, a lot of times I think that we in AA, we take so many things for granted. I think we really do. Remember Bill Wilson saying that AA will survive as long as God wills it. But he also used to say, don't leave everything to divine providence. You got to get in there and hoe a little bit yourself once in a while. Over in Ireland, there's a little homespun philosopher who used to write on the end of his newsstand, out on the middle of one of the main streets in Limerick. And every day he wrote a big piece on there in great big bold letters. And this day he wrote, it's a very sweet thing to do a kind deed which is displeasing to someone you don't like. But I think of the millions of people whose lives have been influenced in a very positive way by Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think it's a wonderful thing to think that it has never bothered anybody. So off the scrap heap of humanity to where I am today, out of that old junkyard to a useful life, I feel very privileged. And I just in closing, I would like to, one of our very great friends, good friends, non-alcoholics from way back in the very beginning, who has passed on since our last international convention, was Burn Smith. And in Miami Beach, he told us that our fellowship is rich in its faith, large in its numbers, and dedicated to its purpose. Indeed, we stand as living proof that a spiritually based society can achieve a durable unity and so serve as a beacon of hope to a world so sadly in need. So I would ask you now to let us now think about letting us all work together to achieve a durable and lasting unity. Let us try to continue to apply to our daily lives the simple tenets of humility, honesty, devotion, love, and compassion.
I always tell the poor folks back home, they get sick of listening to me telling you this, but, you know, the sober members of this fellowship, you're AA's public image. You are the part of the community that the community sees. You know, most of us blew our anonymity the day we quit drinking. Because we quit making all those god-awful noises, roaring and ranting. The police, those flashing lights weren't coming home with us. And all of a sudden, somebody said, what the hell's happened to Pat? And somebody said, well, I think he must have quit drinking. God, he joined AA. Because Alcoholics Anonymous and quitting drinking are synonymous in the minds of people out there on City Street. So, anonymity, I don't worry too much about. I feel very privileged to be a member of this fellowship that has meant so very much to me. So, in closing, I would like, if I had a wish for all of us, I would wish that you live long and die happy. And may a loving God always watch over you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Pat. All to the will of the Irish. It's a pleasure and privilege to sit up here in front and hear the music of your laughter. I fully well know that every person in this room at one time in their life had reached a point where they didn't have much to laugh about. That includes the alcoholics and the non-alcoholics. I think one of the things that I treasure at the little group that I attend, which is a very small roundtable discussion type of meeting, a fellowship hall of a church, and right down the hallway, not too far, is our Al-Anon meeting at the same time. And when I hear the laughter come floating up out of that Al-Anon room, it proves to me that the fellowship of AA can do great and wondrous things, because those girls and guys that are near and dear to the alcoholic didn't have much to laugh about when we decided to come to AA, and I think it is tremendous. Now we'll hop back, and we're not going to go by plane, after Pat told me that, we're going to go some other way, to the Middle West. We'll go back to the dairy state of Wisconsin, and I'll ask Clarence T. to bring a message to you.
I'm Clarence T. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Well, I've got some good news and some bad news to bring you tonight. First, I'll have to give you the bad news. You heard the two speakers, and now you're waiting to hear a third speaker, and you're not going to hear that. I usually throw out a lot of confusion. That's what put me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll try to do my best. But the good news is that it touches a few of the fishermen. There are people who love the fish. That back in Wisconsin, and I know the state of Washington and Oregon, and certainly the coast of California and most of the eastern seaboard, know what coho is. We imported them into Wisconsin, put them in the lake, so we'd have a better game fish to compete with you people out on the coast. And we crossbreed them with we have the muskie and we have the walleye pike, and they got quite confused about arriving at a name for this new fish that they had produced by the crossbreeding. And they decided they would call it the Kowalski. And I want to report that it's been very successful. And it'll soon be around, but we are having one little problem with it. We're trying to teach it how to swim now. I could give you a drunkologue, what it was like before AA found me. I didn't have the courage to find AA. AA came to me. I'm going to say something that I haven't ever said, being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I feel such an honor of being asked to be on this panel, and in a way, it's a celebration for me, too, because as of tomorrow, I'll be constantly dry one day at a time with this way of life for 21 years. I first approached Alcoholics Anonymous in 1949, so you can well see that I've been recapped, rethreaded, and rebooted, and re-hit, and hospitalized, never for alcoholism, but for hypertension. And it was a very mysterious way that I found Alcoholics Anonymous. It was through a party that I didn't know, but somebody else had told somebody else, and somebody else had told, finally, my wife, and they asked me to make the call. Well, you can't get your fingers in those little holes. So I asked her if she would dial a number for me. This man happened to be dry many years before Alcoholics Anonymous came into existence. And he told me where I should go. But if I wasn't capable of going, that he would see that he would contact him and have some fellas call on me. And they did. How can you imagine securing yourself, and I know you can, and that fear of leaving the home, knowing that you'll make today another yesterday of drunkenness? They have these people come and talk to you, and you look at them, and you immediately take the guy that says, I only been sober a couple of days. And you immediately say, hell, I've stayed sober by myself that long. And look down on them. That was my attitude. And that's why it took me that long to arrive at the doorway of Alcoholics Anonymous. But they were persistent. They never turned me down. They are always there with a helping hand. And I know you, too, have people in your area that you get disgusted with, that you feel like throwing up your hands in despair, but you don't. Because there's always that one fella that can come along, and he's the right one. It might be a gentleman will call you a mister, and it might be another gentleman will call you what you really are. And I had that kind of a gentleman. He told me exactly what it was. He had happened to have two strokes, and he asked if he could take a crack at me. I was known as the town drunk. The town wasn't very big now. It's growing up from, I think, around 68,000 to around 87,000. And he came, and he told me exactly what I was. I asked my wife to throw him out of the house. But he was persistent. He didn't leave. And he told me that if I wanted what they had, I would literally crawl on my belly to get it. That from now on, he would accept no excuses from me at all. Unless he read my name in the obituary column. And I looked at this nut, and I immediately assumed that this thing could stay sober. Maybe I could. But what a world of wisdom I found within this man and within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they all seem to repeat about the same thing. If you want what we have, be in attendance regularly without fail. Don't become a Missouri mule, and I hate to refer to the state of Missouri, but we know. But Don't have to have everything proven to you. Stick around. And you might begin to like what you feel. And this absolutely became true. I had graduated from the Great Keeley Chair at Dwight, Illinois twice within 11 months. I'd met a man down there, a doctor, that told me that the only salvation for me would be to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that time, Alcoholics Anonymous hadn't entered into the Keeley Cure Division yet, but later on, they got real active in the Keeley Institute down there. But I told my wife an entirely different story. I told her that the doctor had told me that he had caught me in time. That he didn't think I was an alcoholic, that I should stay away from it for a couple of years, and I felt at that time that I could go 10. And that's exactly the way I felt. I felt physically well when I walked out of there. And anyway, it was none of her business. It was my problem. And she was the cause of it. Actually, today I still wonder. If she wasn't, you know. Because she went to, those days they had an auxiliary. Al-Anon hadn't been founded yet. But they had auxiliaries. And she began to change. It was amazing. So I think if she'd got there first, I don't think I'd have been here today. But I always like to talk about the things that have happened to me after I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I made a lot of mistakes in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I continue to make them. But I recognize them. And the thing about the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you don't recognize them, they'll sure tell you. But they tell you for your benefit and not theirs. And I think we all have had this experience. Sometimes we don't like what we hear. But then there's that old guy in AA who says, take a good look at yourself. Arrive at your own decision. And that's really the truth, isn't it? We arrive at our own decision. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous helps us arrive at that decision. So we must like it. And then they come up with that one that I think is the key to you and I being able to hold on to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Fellowship of AA. Is that they state openly and freely that there is nobody here that can get you sober. And there is nobody here that can get you drunk. This is your choice. All we say to you is to come along and try to work on this pathway of life and the 12 steps of recovery and to learn immediately to become dependent upon a power that is greater than you. And most of us in AA choose to call this power God. Because it's simpler and running around the bush or the trees or, oh, the sun. God, it's much simpler. A God as I understand him. And I heard it mentioned, I think, this evening right now, that never again will you ever walk alone. That your sponsors and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous can be not at your side every second of the day. But if you work this program to the best of your ability, you'll never again be alone. And they tell you that it's much easier to bend a knee than it is to bend the elbow. So start bending your knees. And if you keep forgetting about asking this higher power of yours in the morning for help for that day, not always pertaining to drinking, but just to be another, a little bit better human being for today. No formal prayer is necessary. Just a little heart-to-heart talk between you and your God as you understand him. And he's at your side. Now to hear this, and we the alcoholic, God, how lonesome we were. We could be in a room filled with people such as this, and we were still alone until we recognized that here was love. Here was a love that expected nothing back from you. Here was a love that extended its hands for you to take a hold of and to walk down this new way of life. And they told you that being sober was not enough. And it's not. I don't believe if I came to AA and I just got sober that I would be here. But they said if you work at these steps to the best of your ability, things will begin to change. And hold on. Ask your God for help each morning. And if you're really appreciative, you won't forget to thank him at night. And I can say this. Honestly, I have never failed to do those two things for the past 21 years. What a feeling that you're not alone. What a feeling is you get when you are told that all of these things will come. This happiness that you hear that is guaranteed to you by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's there. This peace of mind and serenity that we seek, that we are always seeking and kept eluding us, just out of reach. It's here. Now, I'm surely not going to stand here and say that I wallow around in this complete peace of mind and contentment and happiness every single minute of the day. It was a little miserable today. But I found that I began to have more peace of mind with the help of you people on a day-to-day basis. That I like that feeling. That peace of mind, I feel that I have more of it. And I like that feeling too. And then they promise you one other thing. They promise if you and I do the best job we can, that you will feel well up in you a confidence that you never thought humanly possible for you or I ever to attain. It's here. It's in the 12 steps to recovery. That is what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous means to me, and I know to you. What love we find in the fellowship. It's like Pat said, our AA up there is the same as it is here. I don't believe it. We're individuals. You'll hear that in AA. We all work this program individually. It's a lot of hooey. We might come different ways. We all work it the same. You hear there's no must in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, there are no musts. There's a bunch of you had betters. And you always hear that fellow that says, these are only suggested steps. You can't tell me. What's the book say? Rarely we have we seen a person fail that follow these, our path, and then by the 12 steps. It don't say rarely have we seen that we suggest that you follow these steps. We have to work the steps. And I know I, as an individual, needed all the help I could get. And you were there to help me. You were there to stamp on my foot when I started moving out, like Pat mentioned. You start falling out of shape and become a hubcap or a wheel, and a wheel just goes around in circles. If you can miss the dogs, it won't get near you then, Pat. But I had something else here. Oh, I don't know who put this in here. It says, down the road his funeral goes. As sobs and wails diminish, he died from drinking clear shellac, but he had a lovely finish. I don't know how to say that. I found, to my amazement, I happen to be Roman Catholic, born, raised that, not by choice. I was that when I was born. And a lot of them ask you, you know, you come from a religious family. Yes, I came from one. In fact, my family was so religious they would never do any canning because they wouldn't use any mason jars. Tricks in Alcoholics Anonymous they talk about in meetings, and you know, a guy will come up with this little gimmick and that little gimmick, and they say you shouldn't use these or that. But you'll never know if they'll work unless you try them. And the greatest gift we have is that we always got some prodder in AA in our own group that'll say, why don't you try it? And I can remember the fellow that called on me, he said, listen, don't start telling them what they're doing wrong. He says, I think what you should do, he says, reminds me of when I crossed a tiger with a parrot. And when that parrot talked, you better damn well listen. I was standing down here with the young folks had their dance last night. My wife and I came out, and there was a captain of the Navy. U.S. Navy was standing there, and this drunk come out of that bar in the corner, and he says, doorman, get me a taxi. This captain says, I want you to know, sir, I'm a captain in the United States Navy. He says, well, then Jesus is getting me a boat. I got to get home. Know that feeling of fear. And I've been blessed with Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife and I celebrated, I think, 36 years together. And very blessed years. Some were a little sticky. I heard a guy from England talk in St. Louis, and he's saying things were getting a little tacky. Well, we've been blessed and fortunate that we could attend all these international conferences since 1955. And this one's been the greatest. Not just because I happen to be on the panel, I think the other ones would have made it if I'd been there too. But what a feeling we go home with from these. It lasts 5 years. You'll talk about it. And sometimes I think we who are in a position should think of others and maybe bring a new couple along. Even though sometimes it works a little hardship on us. We should forget that moving away from just feeling I have to get there. should think of our loved ones that are new in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because something like this can carry them for a lifetime. And in conclusion, I want to say this. I went to psychiatrists, and I had a fellow tell me about this psychiatrist. He was having this dream, this constant dream, about this cloud that floated down out of the sky. Stopped by his bed, and he'd look over, and there laid on the cloud this golden screw driver. Looked down at his stomach, and there was a golden screw in his navel. He says, and I wake up, and he says, it's gone. And the psychiatrist says, well, how often does that happen? He says, well, Doc, he says, that happens every night. He says, well, he says, the next time that happens is you. Take that golden screw driver off of the cloud, and you remove that golden screw out of your navel, and you lay it back up on that cloud. So, by gosh, the next night he went home and went to bed, it happened. And he did exactly what the psychiatrist told him. Here comes that cloud. Look, sure enough, there was that golden screwdriver. So he reached over and took it off of there, and he removed that golden screw out of his navel, and he put that on the cloud, and the screwdriver back on the cloud, and away the cloud went. And he slept right on until morning. So he was so excited when he woke up, he got up and his ass fell off. I think there's a lot of AA in that. But I want to say this much. I want to thank you all for listening. And I want to thank the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for helping me each day of my life in AA. And may God go with you, and God bless you all. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Clarence. What humor and what a message. Now comes the dubious honor of getting to listen to me. I have seniority, calendar-wise and sobriety-wise, but I'm no public speaker. I cannot tell stories. I can't remember stories. I write them down. I can't even read them right. So I'll dispense with any stories. I'm under a handicap. I got to keep my talk pretty honest because my wife's out here in the second row double-checking me. And I want to apologize to my friends from the state of Iowa because they're going to hear something that they've heard over and over and over. But it reminds me of a lady in our fellowship in Cedar Rapids. A lot of people say AA becomes very repetitious. They don't like to go. It gets repetitious. And old Peck said, well, breathing's damn repetitious, but if you want to live, it's pretty important. So I think I read someplace in the big book that when we're asked to speak, we should tell what it used to be like and what we did and what it's like now. So I want to take you on a little journey down through memory, and I hope I can get it straight, not embellish it too much. I'll do my best. I came out of a very Christian family. I'm an only child. I drank the first time I tasted alcoholic beverage. I was 15 years old, and I got drunk, and I passed out. And 30 years later, I got drunk, roughly, and I passed out, and the boys had to haul me home. So I made great progress in my control. I started back in Prohibition days. I don't know anything about fancy social drinking. I can't say that I was ever a social drinker. I started on hooch that I stole off in a bootlegger. I also drank some homebrew. We didn't bother to get around the bottle much of it. We just drank out of the crock. Red Dog and all fancy wines that weren't finished working and all that. You see, I was not a fancy drinker, and I don't know anything about fancy drinking. I like the effect of alcohol. I can't say that my drinking got all haywire in the early years of my life, and that I was an alcoholic from the start. I don't know why, what I was or what I wasn't, and I can care less. That's one thing I like about AA. They don't bother us trying to figure out why we're alcoholics. They just want us to accept the fact that we are. But near as I can pinpoint, I drank about 18 years fairly well on control. I had to be a pretty good salesman to sell this girl that became my bride, because she's a teetotal Methodist. And incidentally, I'm a Mason too, Clarence, so where else can we kid each other but in AA? My drinking escapades weren't too bad, as I say, for about 18 years of my life, and then I seemed to have crossed an invisible line where I went from impulse drinking to compulsion drinking. I don't know just exactly when that was, but I know I crossed it. My drinking got out of control, and living problems got out of control. Oh, I still was functioning fairly normal on the surface. But I have a unique story, and I think it's very fitting to tell this story at a general service conference of this size. Some parts of it that some of it are rather unique. My first knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous was when I read the Saturday Evening Post article in, I believe, March of 1941. I grew up in a home where the Post was one of the standby magazines. Oh, living problems got out of control. Oh, I still was functioning fairly normal on the surface. But I have a unique story, and I think it's very fitting to tell this story at a general service conference of this size. Some parts of it that some of it are rather unique. My first knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous was when I read the Saturday Evening Post article in, I believe, March of 1941. I grew up in a home where the Post was one of the standby magazines, and I had read it avidly for many years. And I read this article about Jack Alexander's tremendous article, which has been one of our leading pamphlets, and with much interest. And believe it or not, I think I admitted that there was something wrong with my drinking, and I'll tell you why. I saved the address of the General Service Office in New York City, and what did I need with that address if there wasn't anything wrong with my drinking? I saved it, carefully hid it away. I don't think even let my wife knew I had that address. And in the summer of 1943, I wrote the New York office. And they come back with a beautiful letter and thanking me and saying there wasn't a group in the state of Iowa. So I wanted to go to AA and it wasn't available. So I continued to drink. And I believe, I'm not too sure of this, but I believe that after the group got started in my hometown in 44, spring of 44, that I got a second letter from the General Service Office telling me that a group had started in my hometown. And unfortunately, this wife of mine got a hold of it, and I shouldn't use that word this, but my wife got a hold of the letter, and I went to my first meeting. You know, they talk about there's motivators. I was motivated by having my right arm up behind my back. I could scratch my left ear with ease. And I went to my first meeting in the Montrose Hotel in Cedar Rapids in the corn room. I can say that Al said, well, one of the competitors, he sold his hotel and quit. And you know, these distinguished experts, March till June is not a very long period of time, is it? They knew a lot about AA. They gave me a written examination to see whether I qualified for membership. And I haven't been able to find very many people that ever took a written examination to see whether they were qualified for membership in AA or not. I believe our tradition says a desire to stop drinking. But anyway, I took this written test. And I can remember sitting on that little table in the corner of the corn room in this hotel. Little beads of blood almost sweat on my brow. Trying to answer these questions. I'm a con artist. You know what I'm talking about. I wanted to get a favorable readout when they corrected my paper. So these three guys, and I can still see these three. One of them, in fact, this gentleman turned out to be my sponsor. Was my sponsor's sponsor. I think he was the one that created the paper, and that was a one-legged guy that lives in California now. And another guy, they graded my examination paper, and they come over to me, and this one-legged fellow said, according to the way you answered these questions, we don't consider you an alcoholic. Now, can you imagine that happening today? So I went home to my wife, and I said, no, I've been to AA, and they're experts and they're authorities. And they say I am not an alcoholic. And I said, and I want you to listen careful to this. I said, the job I have, there's a lot of pressures. My home life doesn't exactly run too smooth. It's quite a bit of nagging and fault finding and all of that. I have to drink for relief. Also, in my job of supervision, I must be a good fellow and drink with the boys. And roar down the road of self-destruction. I tell the story a lot of times to new people. God, the room's empty since I get up here. Look at the empty chair. Everything was full. I get up now. They're hungry. I know. They're going to go out and get a bite to eat and listen to the good speaker after they hear me. I should have stuck around. I'd appreciate those guys tonight that follow me. I decided I would return to controlled drinking or social drinking. Now, I don't know how to return to social drinking. There was one. I don't know how to return to what you've never been. And I went on a self-help kick that lasted for years. And I tell it to the gentleman for the benefit of comparatively new people. And I think all of we alcoholics, after we cross that invisible line, have worked so darn hard on trying to figure out some way to learn to control our drinking. That old denial thing that we're not abnormal. I tried everything I could think. Well, anyway, I have to tell you that my wife is a very determined, strong-minded person, and she was going to make me quit drinking. I don't know any other wives ever did that, tried it. But I think a few boys in the AA have been through the treatment that they had to quit drinking. It always irks me when somebody says an alcoholic is weak-willed. I don't agree with that at all. I was strong-willed. I willed to drink and nobody could blast me out of it. Now, I had some experts work on me, as I'll tell you about. So I don't know whether chronological order is right or not, but our town didn't have any mental health center. So my wife, along with a lot of other ladies, I don't think all these were wives of alkies, but anyway, they got together and they got a mental health center started in Cedar Rapids. And my wife and I were the first married couple to go in through the mental health center. In fact, we went in with the folding chair furniture. And I got assigned to a psychiatrist, a preeminent psychiatrist in Cedar Rapids, and I had many, many, many sessions with this man. And truly, he's a wonderful fellow. I'm not putting down any of these professions at all. The trouble is, I wouldn't cooperate with him. He was trying to get into my mind and find out what made me tick. And if anybody can throw up a defense around not letting people get next to him, it's an alcoholic, see. And, of course, the thing he was doing was trying to determine why I was an alcoholic. And then there's nice and AA, we don't do that, as I said before. And I was amused when I think back now one time. I was a little kid on the farm. This will sound ridiculous, but we went into this. Was there anything abnormal in my childhood? And, of course, I had to satisfy him with something. And I said, well, yes, something abnormal. When I was about 2 or 3 years old, I had a habit of running off to go out in the field where my dad was plowing or something. So my mother put me in red dresses. Little boy wore dresses then, and so she could see me a long way. He said, maybe that's it. Maybe that warped your self-esteem and so forth. I don't think it had anything to do with it at all. Well, after a long period of this, Why, the good doctor got worn out because I wouldn't cooperate. I went down for one of my sessions. And can't we play games? Can't we con? Can't we take the monkey off our back and put it on somebody else's back? He just bumped me, told me, he said, you're taking up my time and I'm taking your money. We're not getting anywhere. And I said, well, what in the world am I going to do? Well, he said, I'm not going to tell you what you're going to do, what you should do. I'm going to ask you a question. Have you ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, yes. And he said, fine. And that was the end of that session. So my wife still was not satisfied. She got me to go down to University of Iowa Hospital to the psychopathic hospital as an outpatient. I've dealt with the experts. This guy that I went down there, the doctor was assigned to, later became the head of the whole psychiatric department down there. So I wasn't fooling around with some amateur. In fact, my wife went with me, and she went, don't make it too rough on me tonight, honey. And, when I come out of that session, I'll show you the accountability of a practicing alcoholic. He took my wife to task because she was too narrow-minded, and she was too puritanical. And what she should do was to have beer available in the icebox, so when I came home from work, I could sit down and enjoy a cold bottle of beer. I never took a drink in my own home, never had no desire to, so I went home, I was scot-free on that. And then I think that Clarence mentioned something about the clergyman, so I thought, well, maybe I can get help from the clergyman. So I went to this Methodist minister that's at my church, and he didn't know anything about drinking. He had no help for me at all. So I thought, well, of course, Methodists don't. At that time, they're supposed to be teetotalers. So I thought, well, maybe a Roman Catholic priest might be able to help me. And my wife, she didn't know about it, so I went to him, and he didn't know more about what to do about it than the Methodist minister did. So I felt let down. And then I went on the self-help kick of buying books. Power of Positive Thinking and Know Thyself and the whole bit. I've got a shelf of books at home 6 feet long. Beautiful books. Beautiful books. Wonderful books. Nothing wrong. Everything I'm talking about that I went to and resorted to is good. It was just one thing. There was just one key. I didn't have any desire to stop drinking. Period. I went through this rigmarole. You know, they talk about motivators, what motivates people to get the AA. Well, family is one of them. And then there's the jobs, another one that motivates you, and the law. And I had to get that straightened out quick. I never even had any trouble with the law. Never had an officer of the law talk to me. I don't know how I got through the nets of beautiful, but I did. No trouble with the law. The doctor... Well, my doctor, he thought I was drinking too much. He kept insisting it'd be good if I'd cut down. And I said, my wife, you know that. He's getting old. He's getting to be a kind of a quack. I said, I think we better go on to another doctor. And I guess I'll talk about the job first. This is a ring around the rosy deal, this job thing. I had a good job. Real good job. I drank with my boss. He could drink me under the table, which was a pretty good feat, and I had a guy that worked for me, and I could drink him under the table. So I fired a guy that worked for me because he drank too much. And my boss got me in, and he got narrow-minded about absenteeism, guess, but, you know, caused by what, and he fired me.
The master tape cut off at this point. This is the end of the talk as we have it.